Good evening and welcome to a Max Headroom Myth Special. You are listening to Tara Judah,
Josh Nelson,
and Cerise Howard.
And we're going to be talking about MIFF, the Melbourne International Film Festival, on 3RRR 102.7 FM. And we're going to be discussing some of the films that we've seen up until now, day six of the festival, I think we're in today.
Seven?
Eight? They go so fast.
Lost count.
It could be. There's many days to go, and the end is not yet in sight. So we will be talking about what we've seen, a little bit of reviews, and then some discussion towards the end on a few things that have been, a few concepts that have been thrown up quite vividly by the festival. So let's start with, there's a couple of films all three of us managed to see, and that there's not that many of them, so given how many sessions there are in this festival.
Scheduling is difficult, Tara.
Scheduling is difficult. It's one of the great feats. If you can master that, you can win the festival. So we'll start with The Sapphires, which was the opening night film at this year's Melbourne International Film Festival. Who wants to begin?
Cerise, go
Josh,
for it.
Josh, this has got you written all over it, hasn't it? Okay, well, lovely to have a crowd-pleasing Australian film to kick things off, which is even in release, I think, today. So anyone who missed out shouldn't feel too irked not to have been there, though the party was fun. The Plaza Ballroom is an underutilised space. I'm always very happy to be granted access to that really gorgeous space beneath the Regent. The Greater Union Cinemas, the host of the opening night film and in all six of its auditorium, I'm a little less fond of, personally. They're a bit hit and miss. The whole thing actually looks like the rear of it, one of those air conditioners, those units you see in office blocks all throughout the city in those older postmodern buildings. You know, do you know what I mean? There's things like this brutalist aesthetic I'm not over fond of.
But the film you were fond of?
I was fond of the film. It's not a perfect film, but it's a very enjoyable film.
Yeah, I have to say I found The Sapphires to be a little bit weak. I didn't actually see it at opening night. I saw it a little bit earlier. And for me, there were a few issues. I think that the scripting's good in part and not so good in other parts. And I think that some of the performances, whilst the singing's very good, some of the acting performances are let down in certain scenes. And it's very kind of cheesy and cliched. I think that for me, some of those moments, I know that's what makes a well-rounded, broad appeal kind of hit film in this sense. I think this film is going to be somewhat like Red Dog. I think it's really going to take off with Melbourne audiences and Australian audiences. I think it's going to be very popular. But overall, I think it's a very weak film, and you don't get much of a sense of what's actually going on in the Vietnam War, which is really odd as it's the major backdrop.
That was something I had problems with. In fact, given that I was at opening night, I felt like a bit of a pariah and had to keep my opinions to myself, keep them very quiet, because there was a lot of love being thrown around and I wasn't feeling it to the same way everyone else was. I think part of the problem is the Vietnam section. Once the film gets to Vietnam, it seems to lose a sense of direction and momentum. It felt like the four major female performers and their Irish band manager kind of get there and then it's like, well, what do we do now? And there wasn't a sense of them confronting the horrors of Vietnam gradually, or the horrors sort of seeping into their Showtime existence. The other strange thing that I found about the Vietnam sequences in particular was the tonal shifts which worked earlier in the film between the kind of the overly comic sensibility and some of the moments of seriousness, particularly with the aspects of the Stolen Generation and the racism, didn't seem to gel as well in the Vietnam sections, to a point where they had a comic voiceover at the same time that Deborah Malman is bawling her eyes out. And it seemed too, the extremes there were sort of too extreme, and I didn't feel anything. I no longer was amused or upset. It was like, well, you've lost me. I'm not sure what I'm supposed to be.
That was exactly the scene that really did not work at all for me and completely lost me too. I couldn't understand why there was a comic voiceover with crying. I still can't understand that. I'm not really sure what response from the audience you would be trying to elicit with that.
Well, the response it seemed to elicit overall was a pretty positive one. I think the vibe at the party was very upbeat. It didn't hurt that performers from the film were then on the stage kicking out the jams. And look, I really did enjoy this film. It was I thought it got the festival off to the sort of start I'd like a festival to start with, the right sort of energy. There have been a couple of catastrophes in recent years. This was a much better start to what so far for me been a pretty enjoyable festival.
And the next one is Beasts of the Southern Wild, which I think actually we all saw pre-festival. And this is a very curious film that that isn't very much like other films that you will have seen with similar subject matter?
It's like one. The filmmaker made a short I caught a few years ago called Glory at Sea. And when I was watching Beasts of the Southern Wild, I had this nagging feeling that I must have seen this director's work before. There's something very familiar about it, but still unique. I haven't seen anyone else do this. I was very relieved when I discovered it was the same filmmaker, Ben Zeitlin, a guest at this year's festival. Beasts of the Southern Wild is something of a magic realist Louisiana bayou fable with a bit of climate change terror thrown into the otherwise heartwarming story of a six-year-old largely fending for herself in the bathtub, the so-called bathtub, the rather waterlogged part of Louisiana, not separated by a levee, which I don't believe has been built in the real world to this day, to which on the other side of which the rest of civilization seems to be living and largely oblivious to the fact there are a few holdouts living it up, boozing it up in the swamps.
I got really caught up with this film. I mean, maybe I'm a sucker for a coming-of-age tale anyway, but this one really grabbed me in an interesting way because of, I think, it got the mix between the fantasy, magic, realist, you know, seeing things through a child's eyes, and that sort of slightly more removed sensibility. I think Ben Zeitlin is a really fascinating director, and I heard him interviewed on TV or on radio this morning, and he was talking about the casting process, and pretty much everyone in the film is non-professional actors, including the young girl. In fact, the one who plays her father, who is quite a remarkable performance in itself, he ran a donut shop across the road from the production company, and they went, you know what, you'd be right for this role. How you find that between a poverty-stricken drunkard and someone who makes the best donuts in New Orleans, apparently. But there you go. Tara, what did you think?
Yeah, this was a funny one for me because I watched it and could marvel at how accomplished it was and really think it's a very good film, but didn't actually find the personal access at all. I constantly felt like I was viewing this film at a very great distance. There was something between it and I, and I'm not sure whether or not the thing that I think it might be down to is the fact that the protagonist is a six-year-old child. And not that means that there's anything wrong with the performance or that character isn't well created, because it is, but just that I think it's difficult to identify with a six-year-old child. I found that very hard. I found assuming her perspective something difficult because, you know, obviously there are times where she does relatively stupid and foolish things.
You were once 6 years old, weren't you, Tara, at some stage?
Apparently, but who can remember? Who can recall?
I'd remember the sort of events that, I think some of what she undergoes in this film would be the stuff of traumas recurring throughout the rest of your life. But she's a hardy little sort, so I really got caught up in her adventures. A sequel, perhaps?
Well, one of the things that this film's thrown up is the depiction of poverty, and it seems to be dividing. I mean, I think the overwhelming response so far has been quite positive to this film, but one of the issues that I know some people have had is whether it exploits. I mean, I think I've heard the term poverty porn being bandied around. Is it just completely exploitative and let's indulge how awful these people's lives are, particularly the inhabitants of the bayou in the bathtub or the washtub, whatever it's called? I didn't find that. I didn't find it exploitative. And where I think it humanizes these people without exploiting them is that contrast we get later in the film where we have the sterile shelters and where these people are being sort of tossed into, which is so dehumanizing by contrast that I think the sense of community that you get in the bathtub is really incredible. I think, and I don't think it exploits the characters. I think it's there, but it's not saying let's pity these poor souls.
Yeah, the poverty porn thing, I really don't enjoy the sort of sanctimony that some people apply such terms to. But that said, I saw Killer Joe last night, and that really, really shat me to tears. And part of it was because it was clearly the work of privileged people behind the camera and in front of it playing at being trailer trash. And it was a bad film. William Friedkin, you can do so much better. What was that all about?
I'm going to have to agree. I saw Killer Joe as well in this festival. We were going to I'll quickly run through why I didn't like it, which I think are very similar reasons to you, Cerise. But for me, what's really the main issue with this film is, and they do a really great, there's a very great job done to make sure that Killer Joe is extremely charismatic. Matthew McConaughey gives a brilliant performance, but what's problematic about that is that this charismatic performance seduces the audience to aligning themselves with him and his views and the way in which he enters into a very poor kind of trailer trash home and assumes control over them. And then continues to essentially humiliate the family members, really one by one in different ways. And the problem is that the enjoyment that the audience then experiences is not at the concept, it's not black comedy, it's not at the concept of what is going to happen, it's actually at the humiliation. It's enjoyment, it revels in its violence, it revels in its misogyny.
Misogyny is out of this park, out of this trailer park.
It really is. It's like a new level of unbelievable misogyny in this film. And it continues to do that to the point, though, where I actually found the viewing experience incredibly disturbing because there were people in the auditorium who were laughing at things that I really don't think it's okay to laugh at.
And you're listening to MIFF Special, a Melbourne International Film Festival special, The Legend of Caspar Hauser. This is a strange film. I think in the guide it was referred to as a post-Western, whatever that is, I'm not quite sure, starring Vincent Gallo. And I think it's a mythical retelling told in a very curious, partly detached way. Look, I had fun with this film almost in spite of myself, because one of the problems I had, the cynical part of my mind is saying this is a pretentious piece of art if it wants to pretend it's art. That's basically an extended promo for Adidas sportswear. The product placement in this film is almost obscene, and I don't think there's any irony in the way in which it's presented. Having said that, once I got over that kind of that feeling or that reaction, there is a lot of fun to be had, and I think part of it is the music. The music is so hard not to get kind of caught up in.
Just as the characters, such as they are, I mean, they're pretty thinly sketched, and Vincent Gallo in as many as two roles as well, just watching them dance, it's pretty entertaining, Gallo especially. But also this enigmatic, legendary Caspar Hauser figure, played by a very androgynous creature. Had to check the closing credits to determine which gender, ultimately, he or she was. I shan't spoil it. Leave it to people to have a ponder over themselves. There's very little plot, but it's based on a person we know existed in history, one of these so-called wolf children, these people who emerge from the wilderness. Maybe they speak their own language, baffling creatures who have somehow survived. In this film, washes up on shore. Caspar does, with headphones on, ready to become a DJ, evidently. It's a film of images and movement and sound, great sounds, and considerable silliness. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, no, there's definitely fun to be had. I think in the end the fun won me over, but it did take a while, particularly with the washing up wearing an Adidas tracksuit and then him saying, look, you're wearing Adidas, you should wear a different Adidas top. I was like, okay, I got it. Adidas is fronting some cash for this product. I got it. But yeah, the music won me over.
Tara?
Well, a less successful, in my opinion, comedy of this festival would be one that you also saw, Cerise, which is a Greek film called Elle. I found this to be an unbelievably pointless exercise in absolutely nothing. It is probably the most tedious film I have ever laid my eyes upon.
Don't sugarcoat it, Tara. Tell it like it is. Oh, I hated this film. I know some people have really enjoyed it, which boggles my mind. I like my deadpan comedy. I love the films of Roy Anderson, Ilya Suleiman, for example. But those guys make films where the deadpan comedy has a real mordant bite to it. It actually relates to something in the real world, where this really was pointless. And I fell asleep at one point and woke up to find myself extremely annoyed that it was still on. I was really, really annoyed.
I was about to say, I envy you for having managed to fall asleep, because I unfortunately, even though it only runs for about 80 minutes, did sit through the entirety of this rather pointless film.
Well, I'm glad I dodged a bullet by missing this one. I think I had that circled in one of the early scheduling attempts and then I crossed it out. So, yay for me.
Louis Nebel, however.
You read my mind.
Yeah, I thought I might. New Czech film adaptation of a graphic novel. Almost entirely rotoscoped, which is an awful lot of trouble to have to go to. But entirely worth it, because this is an absolutely stunning-looking film, which I enjoyed tremendously, but will concede that if people are not really very well versed in particular historical events in 1945 in Czechoslovakia and then again in 1989, they might find some of this a little impenetrable. But I'd be very surprised if anyone didn't get caught up in the atmospheres of this film. And what really struck me, aside from, I mean, it was an interesting story, but just all of the elemental forces in this, wind, rain, rivers flowing, these things have all been so post-produced, so treated through rotoscoping, and yet they were nonetheless beautiful and still carried something of their elemental power.
I was very chuffed. I mean, we saw this together, and I have to admit, a lot of the politics and social context was lost, even though I was aware that it was sort of present in the film. But I was quite chuffed because I sort of tweeted my love for this film, and I realised today one of the co-creators has retweeted my little love in. So that was a kind of a nice touch.
It's love.
But particularly the use of light. I don't think I've seen many animations that have used light in such a stark way. The use of darkness and the use of bright white light, particularly being a black and white animation. There's this sort of pulsating sequence where we're sort of travelling down this hallway and this light is sort of gradually spilling out from this room and we're not sure what's on the other side. It's almost a dream sequence, but I don't think the way in which that film captured light was incredible. And, you know, it has such a sort of a beautiful noirish sensibility, this film. Yeah, this is one of the treats of the festival for me so far.
Yeah, me too. You know, it's truly bleak, but beautiful, bleakly beautiful.
I'm looking forward to catching that one. I missed the first session, but it is playing again during the festival, so there is another opportunity to look at it, and I think I will be taking that opportunity.